Well, hi, everybody. I'm Justin Chisholm, and this is the Yacht Racing Podcast, the eighth of our weekly Vendée Globe specials. Joining me once again from his home in Lorient in northern France is ocean racing expert and 2016-17 Vendée Globe competitor, Conrad Coleman.
G'day. Nice to be here again. Thank you.
Conrad, first of all, we're recording this on Christmas Eve. So tell me, do you have everything ready for Santa to visit your house tonight?
I do. I was trying to coach my daughter into leaving me slash Santa some sort of muffins and whiskey, but she has prepared the box of food for Santa, and thus far it looks like it includes the leftovers from the past couple of nights of food. So there's work to be done on that, but everything is ready, just waiting on Santa to rock up and do his business.
Now, I know that it's a difficult time for parents with COVID-19 pandemic all around the world and Christmas and dealing with all of that. I know that you've had a pretty stressful week getting ready for it. Would you rather be out on the ocean as a Vendée Globe skipper, just worrying about where you are in the race?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a special kind of pressure that they're under. And obviously it is something that is incredibly challenging that they're up to. But there's also a sort of enviable purity to what they're up to. All they need to do is wake up a couple of times a day after a few sort of fitful naps and make a boat go fast. And they don't even need to really think about the strategy too much at the moment. It's just go east as fast as possible and put up the sails until the wind tells you to take them down again. You know, there's something that's pretty beautiful about what it is that they're doing. And it certainly does not compare to the complexity of our daily life here during 2020, that's for sure. They're out there having the time of their lives.
Well, I guess they are. I do feel a little bit sorry for them, though, because, you know, we're getting ready for a well-earned Christmas break. We're recording this a day early so that we get Christmas Day off from our coverage. But for the sailors, it's just going to be another day, isn't it? Or is it? I mean, you've been down there at Christmas. Is it a special day, or does it? Are you just another day alone on your boat?
Another day alone on your boat. Yeah, I've spent two Christmases at sea, once double-handed with Sam Goodchild during the Global Ocean Race, and then during the Vendée Globe myself solo. And yeah, it's certainly a day of a little bit of mixed emotion, in the sense that obviously Christmas is, and the general holidays are a day for getting together and celebrating collectively and getting everybody all together, you know, around a Christmas tree or around the dinner table. And the whole identity of the day is getting people together, which obviously is a challenge in 2020. And so it does certainly strike a bit of a knife to the heart when you're sort of there by yourself. And sure, you've prepared a day of special freeze-dried for the occasion, but it certainly does make you feel a bit lonely. You've got some presents to open, and it's nice to sort of decorate the boat a little bit and get into the spirit, but almost that makes it worse, because then you're just sort of rubbing your nose in the fact that you don't have the normal Christmas. But then equally, it is just another day. You know, you're going to get splashed in the face by the Southern Ocean that's at 3 to 5 degrees. And your job, as always, is to make the boat go as fast as possible and as safely as possible. So nothing really changes, but certainly a day of mixed emotions when you're out there at sea, that's for sure.
The sailors can speak to their loved ones and the shore team and their families back at home, so they're not totally alone without anybody to speak to. Does that make it, from your experience, does that make it better, or does it just feel kind of worse once you hang up the sat phone?
Yeah, you're right, and never more so than now, because the changes in the satellite connections between 4 years ago and now means that everybody has an always on connection. Most of the boats have WhatsApp running on board, and they're chatting away either to family, friends, or their technical team. So certainly they are at the end of the world, but never more so connected than they have been before. So I think that it goes a long way towards reducing that distance, but certainly when you do get that final click, then the solitude comes rushing back pretty significantly. And for those of you who haven't done a lot of talking on a sat phone, it's kind of like a dodgy cell phone connection from the 1990s when somebody is halfway in a tunnel. You know, the voice is a little bit garbled. There's a decent amount of latency. So there's a pause between talking and hearing. And you're never quite 100% sure that the voice is going through and the message is getting through. So it can sometimes be a bit frustrating. So yeah, special day, but ultimately go east, go fast.
Just before I finish laboring this Christmas point, we're talking about the skippers and their situation and their isolation, but like a word for the families as well, who are almost in a worse position because they're back at home having to deal with the normalities of life and Christmas with, you know, possibly with family and with children. And they've also got the worry of their loved one who's in a fairly precarious position out on the ocean.
That's right. I think that you know, the empty place at the table certainly weighs pretty heavily. I know certainly from the experience of my wife and during my career thus far is that she, you know, jumps at every phone call for the three months that I'm away, thinking that I might be for the worst. We as fans are all glued to the tracker, but the families are certainly doing likewise, keeping tabs on their loved ones. And so for sure, you know, it's a solitary race. You're out there by yourself, but the shared experience is that it is an exceptional year for both you and those at home. That's for sure.
And as we keep saying on the podcast, it's a solo race around the world, but it's very much a bigger thing than that. It's much more of a team sporting event for sure, with the Shore team, the families, everybody, the sponsors, everybody involved in that. Now, let's move on and look at the racing. It's looking pretty interesting out there. When I took a glance at the tracker this morning, I was a little bit shocked by what I see. So, Conrad, can you just give us a description of how things are on Christmas Eve for the Vendée Globe?
My sort of forecast from last time that we talked a week ago was that it was going to get pretty complicated in terms of the weather, and that the next week was going to be dominated by this high pressure zone that has sort of smothered the leaders, and that has certainly proved to be the case. This high pressure zone has sort of sat on top of the leading trio of Yannick Bestaven, Charlie Dalin, and of course Thomas Orion, and it's funny, you know, we talk a little bit about the elastic or the accordion effect of having the fleet compress and expand, and it's sort of concurrently done both of those things, in the sense that it's allowed the delta, that or the difference between the chasing pack and the leading trio, to expand. Because there has been this barrier of no wind sort of blocking the road, and yet all the boats from fourth place position Boris all the way through Giancarlo Pedotti or Louis Burton has massively compressed. So it's done sort of both of those things, and really it's quite exciting because this time last year, or last edition, 4 years ago, 45 days into the race, Armel Lecléache was approaching Cape Horn, and he was almost there. And then Alex Thompson was 570 miles behind, and then third place was 1,500 miles behind. So here you can fit the entire top 10 and change into the delta between first and second 4 years ago. So it's really been quite remarkable this year just keeps on getting more and more challenging in the sense that, you know, we started this race speculating about just how fast they could go in this new generation of foiling boats, and they're going to knock the socks off all the records out there. And this time, not only are they more than a week off the pace, but they're all compressed and fighting each other for every inch out there. So, you know, as a spectator, it's a pretty cool race. But for those that are actually out there, I'm sure they're reveling in the opportunity to measure themselves against their compatriots and their competitors. But it's certainly not the typical Vendée Globe Southern Ocean experience that we've seen in previous editions.
Now, there's a couple of obvious follow-up questions to that situation, Conrad. One is anybody, do you think, starting to ration their food at this point? Because if we're that far behind, that's a whole week, I think you said. That's a lot of food.
What an awful thing to be talking about on Christmas Day. I mean, I was just thinking that as I was saying it. I had quite an old boat last time round, and I hoped to finish the lap in 90 days. I brought 100 days of food with me, and because of my dismasting and associated complications, I ended up doing it in 110 days. And I lost 10 kilos because I was rationing before the end of the race. And then when my mask came down, I spent 4 days drifting around circles. And then when I put the mask back up, that was the last day that I had any decent food on board, and then had 800 miles to sail under jury rig. So, you know, I certainly broke into my survival rations, and I would be surprised if we don't see some pretty skinny faces when we finally make it to Les Sables d'Olonne, because I think you're exactly right. You know, that in the knowing that this was going to be a competitive race, I think that the fleet have been pretty punchy when it comes to bringing spares and food with them, and absolutely drawing that down to the smallest amount possible to keep the boats as fast as possible. And really, they're just being sideswiped by the weather from day one, basically. You know, they just haven't got a break. They haven't been able to catch up the miles lost. And every ocean, be it the Indian Ocean that gave them a kick in, or the calms of the South Atlantic, or the failure of the trade winds in the North Atlantic, you know, for every single major milestone of this race, they've been slow and sticky. So yes, they're going to be skinny and hungry for the last part of this race, for sure.
And the other aspect that comes with this slowdown in the race, or this slow race that they're in, is just the mental pressure that I feel like it's been piled on in this race compared to what they must have been expecting. Because by this stage, you're into the Pacific. It's we expect the boats to be a little bit more spread out. We're not expecting the pressure of boat-on-boat racing, which we're seeing. And I just wonder whether, you know, we've heard Charlie Dallin talk about, you know, the stress that he was under with his repair, and also, you know, now he's got this, you know, how do I get out of this high-pressure system, and what if the other boats get a jump on me? And I seem to pick up certainly from that leading trio a lot of stress. Which they might not have been planning for at this stage in the race.
Well, I think it's going to be a different flavor of stress. Nobody goes into this thinking that it's going to be easy. And you know, the famous quote, which is oh so true, from Michel Desjoyeaux, who won this race twice, obviously, he said, "You have to be mentally prepared for a mechanical breakdown every single day that can put your race in jeopardy. And if you're not mentally prepared for that, then you're just going to get broken by the workload of putting these boats back together, and also the emotional load of the ups and downs, the absolute roller coaster of, yay, I'm going fast, I'm going really fast, and then ping, something goes wrong, and then your race is ruined, and can I get back? And, you know, can I do what Louis Burton did by finding an island in the middle of the South Pacific to shelter behind and then climb the mast three times in order to save his mainsail? Like, it's heroics physically what he did. But even though it's not so visible, everybody is doing that kind of management, self-management, wrenching every day to a degree. And then as you quite rightly say, add to that the fact that you've got a boat that's a stone's throw away, and if you do a bad jibe or you do a sail change that means that you're, you know, up on deck for a little bit longer or whatever, then you know that the other boat's going to get a jump on you, then, you know, this really is like Figaro sailing. You know, just look at the trio of Jean Lacan, Boris Herman, and Benjamin Dutroux. You know, they are literally sailing in each other's pockets after 45 days. It's really astonishing. And while that is exciting, it, you know, adds a little spice to the event. You're quite right to say that that's going to be a heavy load to bear for so long.
You mentioned Louis Burton. When these guys write the story, the book about their Vendée Globe experiences, that's one of the books I want to read, because he has had an absolute roller coaster ride of a race. He's kept a lot of it kind of secret, but as you say, he had to stop at Macquarie Island to climb his mast to make repairs. And I'm sure you saw the video that he posted from the top of the mast, where he the elation of having completed the repair, he was literally howling into the wind. Yeah. That he was going to get back in the race. But he also said, I hate climbing the mast. I hate being up here when I'm on my own. It's so frightening. And then he panned his head cam down to the boat below and then across to the island. And you really got this sense of being so isolated in such an isolated place and having to do these just, you know, daring, mind-bogglingly daring climbs to make these repairs. I thought it was by far the best piece of a video I've seen from the race so far.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And I think you're right to put it in perspective of just how difficult it is, and physically, and then also just the stakes, you know, that he was ready to pull out of the race at that time. It was literally his last gamble to save his race. And he put everything that he had into it and managed to find a solution. So, you know, I don't know if I've said this in previous editions, but sometimes I go and I talk to young school kids about the Vendée Globe, and they always sort of stand up and give me the same kind of questions of, am I afraid of the storms, or am I going to get eaten by a shark, or, you know, how do I poop? And they always ask, you know, what is it that scares you the most? And without hesitation, it is absolutely climbing the mast, because it is there that you have the greatest risk of getting hurt on board. That, you know, every time that you climb a mast, you feel it for 3 days afterwards, because it's an intense physical effort. It's worse than mountain climbing, because you know you're having to use mountain climbing equipment, but you're doing it on a dynamic and wildly swinging spar without the stability of being able to count on gravity. And then, you know, not only just go up there and go for a sightsee, but actually be functional and tie yourself on and protect yourself so that you can actually do the job that you're meant to do when you're up there. You know, it's really tough to use words that give it justice. It is terrifying. It is stressful, and he had to do a series of them back to back, as I have previously. And hats off. That is absolutely brutal. It is the worst task on board, absolutely.
That's fantastic insight. The good news for Louis Burton is he seems to be staging a bit of a comeback, because he is, while everybody else is slowed down, he looked to be romping along this morning.
Well, yeah, that's right. I was writing in the article, which will be up on the website shortly, that that we've seen Clarisse and Romain Athanasio to be quite conservative in the way that they've approached this quite intense depression that's been coming down from New Zealand. I was talking to my mum back in New Zealand, and she said that it just wallops New Zealand, and now it's sort of heading, as they say, safely offshore, except for the sailors who are there. And we've got basically everybody else who's steering well clear of it or choosing a conservative route through. And Louis, by consequence of his delay at Macquarie Island and his position in the south, has no get out of jail free card here. You know, the way that he can preserve himself and his boat is by as he's been doing the past day, sail as fast as you possibly can to get in front of it and allow the storm to charge south behind him and take his transom. And then, you know, he doesn't have any opportunity to bail out to the south and sail more downwind angles. You know, he's got to stay with pretty engaging, tight reaching angles to stay away from the ice explosion zone. And so if it gets too windy and it's fully expected to be sort of 50 knots eventually, then he'll have to go into survival mode, but still in that reaching angle. So he's got a lot on. It's not the sort of R&R rest and recovery mode that you would expect from such an engaging series of repairs.
It'll be another fantastic chapter in that book, which I hope is translated into English, because I'm looking forward to reading it. Now, let's talk a little bit about the top three. Some interesting maneuvers, three kind of quite diverse strategies here. So talk us through it from north to south.
Well, north to south, starting with Thomas Rion, he is currently reaching just east of north at the moment, in clearly making a big commitment to getting as far away as he possibly can from this bubble of high pressure. And there's currently a low that is descending southwards onto their position as well. So very shortly, they will have sustained wind. And as we're writing at the moment, his speed is up to 9 knots, whereas his neighbour, the boat that's winning or leading at the moment, is up to 12 knots. Yannick Bestevin is making a break for it, heading in a pretty positive CMG mode. So a CMG is course made good, so it means that he's not only sailing fast, but sailing in approximately the right direction, in contrast to Thomas. And this whole scenario has been definitely trying for Yannick, in the sense that he's had to stay out in front of the evolution of this high pressure zone. Excuse me. But out of the trio, he has he's been the one that's been least penalized by it. And actually, reading his blog and looking at his videos, is that he's been able to get good chunks of sleep. His boat has been sailing by itself. Making really good progress. And if I was his competitors, I would be scared about that, because he has been recovering, whereas the other ones have been struggling. And he is increasing his gain all the time. Basically, we're going to see him sail on starboard, heading northeastwards, and then finally get up to a position where he'll tack over sort of late Friday, Saturday European time, getting over the top of a little depression cell, the one that's moving south, and then he'll start sort of reaching back and lining himself up for the horn finally, or at least going through Point Nemo. And things look less clear for Charlie, you know, that he is still stuck in the bubble of the high pressure zone. As a consequence of his more southerly position, means that he can't get up to the fairer breeze like Yannick, and it looks like Maître Coq and Yannick are really going to stretch out on the other two at this point.
Do you think Charlie has been trapped down there, or has he just made a decision to take the shortest route and take whatever breeze he gets at this stage?
Well, he's kind of had his hand forced by the situation. That he earlier in the week was sort of making comments about Thomas' position further to the north, saying that it could really pay, it could be really painful, and that he thought that the lowest risk option was to try and skirt the worst of the calms as far south as possible, knowing that he would be sailing fewer miles and that the evolution of the high pressure zone would eventually liberate him. And that's certainly what's been happening, but it just means that in reality we've seen that Yannick make a much more successful job of it than he has.
So over this Christmas period, when do you think we're going to be able to see who's come out of this on top?
Oh, I think by Boxing Day. it'll be pretty clear as to who has won and who has lost out of this episode. So a couple more days, and then everybody should have a little bit more clarity as to what's going on with the leading trio, at least. But as for the rest of the top 10, they will be further stuck in light winds and upwind, which I think will cement the separation between the leading trio and everybody else in the top 10.
Now, Conrad, you mentioned Point Nemo. I know what it is. Some of our listeners might not. Just talk a bit about Point Nemo and tell me, does it have any significance for the skippers? Because I know the media love it.
Well, what can you not love about the most isolated point on Earth? Point Nemo derives its inspiration from Captain Nemo, who is the character created by Jules Verne, who is, you know, a society-hating skipper of the Nautilus submarine. And given that he hated everybody with such fervent passion, then we decided that Point Nemo was the most appropriate name for it, because it is the point of inaccessibility, I think, is what its more scientific name is. And it's basically the point on Earth that is as far away from land as you can possibly get. And it's sort of on an east-west side, it's halfway between New Zealand and Chile. And on the northwest, it's halfway between Antarctica and Pitcairn Island in the Pacific. And 4 years ago, I got knocked down and almost lost my mast at that point, and got stuck in a massive, massive storm. You know, much in the same way that Louis was delayed by repairs and then is getting walloped by the storm, I had the same kind of series of events. And the sense of isolation is absolutely palpable. Knowing that you're days away from rescue, that there are no real sort of commercial ships, that there are no fishermen down there, it's you and the seagulls or the albatross, and you feel that very very intensely. You know, you're 1,500 miles away from land, and I know it's a little bit silly, but the orbit of the space station is some sort of 325 kilometers. Above the surface of the Earth, and they have an escape capsule, which means that if they really wanted to get home for dinner, then they could. You know, they're not that far away from you know, hot soup and crumpets, and whereas we are really stuck out there for a long time if something goes wrong. So, Point Nemo, it's a cool place, but it's a cool place to put in the rearview mirror as well.
Yeah, it's a nice place to have had been to, I suspect.
Exactly.
It does give us evidence, and it does highlight the fact that although we're we're on our eighth podcast of this series since the race started, there's still an enormous way to go, and there's still an enormous way to go across the Pacific to get to Cape Horn, which is probably the most significant landmark of this race, other than the start and the finish. It's just stretching away ahead of them, isn't it?
It is. It's you do kind of feel like you're sort of stepping off a cliff or a precipice when you go past New Zealand. That the Pacific Ocean is just absolutely mind-boggling in its enormity. You know, it's cool to think about the fact that the ocean is, you know, two-thirds of the surface of planet Earth, but just the Pacific Ocean, for example, is bigger than the entire surface area of Mars. A whole other planet out there, our closest neighbor, the one that we're looking at going and populating at some point, is smaller than this ocean. So it really is just absolutely ginormous. And to traverse its length, to go from west to east across it is it's mythical. It's very exciting. You do, or at least I do, really have a sense of history of following in the wake of those that have come before us, of the fantastic stories of the tea clippers and the vessels that are carrying wheat from Australia and racing each other across the Pacific around the Horn and then back up to the markets in Europe. And this is a route that sailors have been sailing for generations, centuries. And it's really special to be down there. But as I said before, regarding Point Nemo, you really do feel like you're at the end of the world.
Now, Conrad, I can see the podcast clock is ticking towards 30 minutes we've been talking. That's usually our kind of target time. So let's finish off. I wanted to get you to answer one of our listener questions that came in from Bill Clark from the sailing vessel Seascape Bristol. And Bill says, Conrad, I'm curious to know what happened to your boat Natural Energy after the 2016 Vendée Globe. Do you still have her? She's refitted and sailing now, he asks. And he said, if he remembers correctly, you had solar panels incorporated into the mainsail. I think he means the mainsail. I'm curious to know how that worked for you.
Yeah, she is refitted and sailing and currently doing this race. And it is actually the boat that's currently being sailed by Sébastien Descamaux under the name of Merci, or Thank You. A bit of a long story as to selling it and who ended up with it, a bit of a long story that I won't get into. But anyway, Sébastien ended up with it. And it is currently sailing with the mast from Rich Wilson, the spare mast from his boat that I secured as well. So big thanks to Rich for helping to get the boat back out into the water and back into the race. And yes, I did use the electric motor on board as a source of renewable energy on board, and I also had solar panels on the cabin top and in the mainsail. That was a bit of an experimental sort of prototype where we tried to encapsulate flexible solar panels in thermoplastic film in order to keep them watertight, and sadly it didn't work very well, so they stopped after a couple of days. And even though weight aloft wasn't really the issue, I would much prefer to keep my electrical connections down on deck where I can see them and service them. And so I think that solar panels on the deck, as Alex on Hugo Boss did, is a better solution overall. It's more robust, at least. So yeah, it's nice to see the boat that I shared so many good and bad memories with back out there, and I hope that Seb is able to turn things around and stay in the race.
That's great. Well, I hope that is a comprehensive answer for you, Bill. Thanks for the question, and keep your questions coming in. Get them to us on social media or info@yachtracing.life. We'll get to us too. I think all that remains for us to do, Conrad, is to wish all of the sailors out on the Vendée Globe race course a very happy and a very safe Christmas period. Good luck to the leaders and to negotiating that high pressure, and to all of the others who are chasing to catch them up. We wish you all the same amount of luck. Also, a very happy Christmas to all our listeners.
All our listeners, absolutely. Merry Christmas to you all, and thanks for sharing it with us here at the Yacht Racing Podcast.
Absolutely, we really appreciate you listening, and it's a real pleasure doing this podcast. So I hope you guys are enjoying it too. Conrad, happy Christmas to you and your family too. And
thank you, mate.
I look
you too.
Forward to speaking to you again next week.
Sounds good. Thank you. See you then.